Ages before the dawn of modern medicine, wild animals were harnessing the power of nature's pharmacy to heal themselves. Doctors by Nature reveals what researchers are now learning about the medical wonders of the animal world. In this visionary book, Professor Jaap de Roda argues that we have underestimated the healing potential of nature for too long and shows how the study of self-medicating animals could impact the practice of human medicine. He spoke to Enni Lana from his home in Atlanta, Georgia.
So I am a professor at Emory University here in Atlanta, and so I teach biology courses and I also have a research lab. So the research I do focuses on infectious diseases. I study monarch butterflies. I also look at honeybees, and I've done some work on malaria as well. So yeah, a lot of the things that I write about, you know, are out of my professional interest, but it's such an interesting topic, you know, animals using medication. It's so similar to what we do. So I think it is a very accessible topic. But before I actually went into my research career, before I went to graduate school, that was actually at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland. Before that, I did science writing full-time as a freelance journalist. And so in some ways, writing this book was for me going back to that interest in writing for a broad audience about really exciting science. But again, I think the topic is so exciting and so familiar that it's very easy to grasp and easy to deal with.
You came to an awareness that wildlife know when they're ill and how to cure themselves by studying monarch butterflies. You discovered that adults that were sick and dying with parasites were able to lay eggs on a poisonous plant so that the caterpillars, when they hatched out, could feed on this poisonous plant, which would kill the parasite, rather than laying eggs on ordinary milkweed plants which didn't contain these poisonous alkaloids. Now, how did you know what was going on there?
That's a great question, and thanks for having me. Yeah, so monarch butterflies get sick with a parasite that has got a really long name. Most people call it OE. It's a protozoan parasite, not that different from the parasites that cause malaria in humans. And it makes the monarchs very sick. How they know they're sick, we don't actually know. But what we do know is that they change their behavior when they are sick. And monarch butterflies, as caterpillars, are specialist feeders on milkweeds. Milkweeds come in different species and varieties, and some of them are way more toxic than others. And it turns out that when monarchs feed on the more toxic milkweeds, they become less sick. So somehow these plants are medicinal, they reduce parasite infection and reduce some of the disease symptoms. And it turns out that when female butterflies, when they're laying eggs, and that's actually when they spread the parasites to their offspring, that when they are sick, they prefer to lay their eggs on the more toxic plants, and that makes their offspring less sick once they are born and start eating and start getting infected with the parasite.
So actually, the butterflies are not curing themselves. They're making sure that their offspring are going to have a better chance in life than they would have if they laid the eggs on the usual milkweed.
That's correct. So it's really an example of mummy knows best. And that was also one of the really exciting discoveries in this system, in this story, that it's actually mothers doing medication to their offspring. Because until then, a lot of the examples that we had in animals were really about self-medication, where an animal will choose a medicine to cure itself. And this was a case where, yeah, it's the mothers taking care of their offspring.
The case of an animal fixing itself is very much exemplified by chimpanzees. They seem to be in great communication with their guts, so they know when they have cramps and pains and diarrhea and things like this, and worms. And they eat different things in different ways, depending on what's wrong with them. Stuff that they would never normally eat in 100 years, stuff that tastes awful. The chimpanzees actively seek this out when, you know, by observing them, by looking at diarrhea and stuff coming from them, that they must actually be very ill. Say more about this.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And this is really the first scientific evidence for animals using medication. This was in the 1980s. And what happened is that there was a primatologist, Michael Huffman from Kyoto University, and he worked with Mohamedi Saifu Kalunde, who was a Tanzania National Parks ranger. And so what they were doing, they were actually checking the chimpanzees, they were tracking them, studying them, and they weren't actually figuring out if they were using medication. And this was really kind of a, you know, an accidental finding. They were tracking this particular chimpanzee called Chau Siku. They noticed she was sick, and then they noticed that she started eating a plant that she doesn't normally eat. And she took the plant, it's called bitterleaf. She stripped away the bark, started sucking on the inner part of the branch. And then what they noticed is that the next day she recovered. And so they really tied this to that plant. And what was interesting is that Mohammadi, who was helping with this research, he was also a traditional healer, and he knew that the local people used that plant as a medicinal plant. And then following that, they found out that the plant has chemicals that kill worms. They find that when the chimpanzees have worms in their guts, they're infected, that they use the plant. And then also at the same time, there were a lot of observations that chimpanzees often swallow leaves completely without chewing them, without digesting them. So you can look at the dung of chimpanzees and find these whole leaves in there. And what those leaves have in common is they're very rough. And so what they discovered is that chimpanzees swallow these leaves whole. They don't digest them. And what it does is when it gets to the gut, it essentially removes the worms. And this is a combination because they feel like Velcro. They're kind of really rough. But it also irritates their gut, so they get diarrhea and get rid of these parasites in that way.
Yeah, but there's an arms race because the thing that's causing the infection will evolve to be more efficient. I'm just thinking of fungi in particular. We were talking on a different programme some time ago about a fungus affecting spiders in caves, causing them to change their behaviour so that the fungal spores would drop off the body of the spider who came out from where it normally lived. And you have an example in your book about the same thing happening to houseflies. They get infected by the fungus, the houseflies change their behaviour, they fly up to the ceiling, die, the fungal spores drop off them. But even more gruesome in this case is that the fungus then makes the dead female fly smell very attractively to males who are still alive. The males go to the dead female fly and mate with it because they think it's ever so sexy from the smell of it. And this is another way of spreading the fungus. So how do we know whether in actual fact the creature that changes its behaviour is doing this because it knows it's sick and wants to fix itself, or it's changing its behaviour because the infection is making it do it? As they say, the barristers in the criminal courts, qui bono, who benefits from this?
I love that analogy. But you're absolutely right. There are so many examples of parasites and pathogens that cause the behavior of their hosts for their own benefit. And so you mentioned a really great example of these flies that end up mating with dead females so they can spread the fungus. And, you know, rabies is another great example, the virus that infects people as well as other animals and then goes to the brain and essentially increases this aggressive behavior. So you start biting and thereby spreading the virus. And so, yeah, you have to be really careful when you look at these behaviors. And the most important thing that you need to show is that when the animal changes the behavior, it helps the animal and not the parasite. And so that really means figuring out, does the behavior help? Does it increase the fitness of that animal? Does it reduce disease? Does it get rid of the parasite in some cases? And that is really important, because if you don't do that, then any behavior could be a manipulation of the parasite, like you said.
Yeah, I mean, you've lots of examples of that. You have one where crickets get hairworms. The worms are in the cricket, and the cricket is not very well because it has these worms inside it. And then the cricket then jumps into the water and drowns and kills itself. And at that point, the hairworms come out and mate with each other in the water because they can only mate in water. In other words, the hairworms actually made the crickets, who are land-dwelling creatures, when they have enough of them in their bodies, made them actually drown themselves. So that's certainly changing the behaviour of the infected creature. But something I wanted to ask you was that these poisonous alkaloids, a lot of these things are, that the sick animals eat, are actually bad for them. I mean, if we take too many tablets, we have side effects, and there's side effects as well too. So you were looking at that, and you reckoned that the creatures do actually know that there are side effects that are not good. I mean, you have a wonderful example of woolly bears. Woolly bears are caterpillars, big hairy caterpillars, and they only eat the poisonous alkaloids when they're sick enough to have a chance of getting better. If they're a little bit sick, they just manage to get on without it, offer it up for the holy souls, as we'd say here. If they're absolutely terribly sick and going to die anyway, there's no point in eating the stuff. So they actually only eat the stuff when they're medium sick, when there is a chance that the alkaloids will fix them. So how do the woolly bear caterpillars know I'm only a little bit sick or I'm desperate anyway? In fact, they're triaging themselves, if you put it into hospital parlance. Tell us about that. That seems very interesting.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And you're absolutely right that side effects are very, very common. And it's actually one of the things that we think is essential to assigning behavior as medication, that the animal uses it when it's needed, but avoids it when it's not. And that has to do with those side effects. Like you said, when we take pills, there is the whole, the description of the side effects when we get the box of our pills. And it's the same for animals. Like the plants that the chimpanzees use are really, really toxic. If they eat too much of it, they die. We see the same with monarch butterflies. If they eat too much of the toxic milkweed, they start living shorter as adults. So there's all these things. But yeah, for the woolly bears, it's so intriguing because we know they get attacked by these parasitoid flies that are a bit like aliens. So what these flies do, they lay eggs on or inside the caterpillar, then the maggots start growing inside and eating up that caterpillar from the inside out. And what these woolly bears can do, like you said, is they have a diet, they can eat a lot of different plants, and they can taste these alkaloids, and a little bit of that is fine, too much of it is really bad for them. And when they are infected with a curable dose of these flies, they can actually increase the uptake of these chemicals and thereby cure themselves. Now, how they know they're sick, we don't know, but this is a really great example where we understand how they increase the consumption of these alkaloids that are toxic. And that's because they have a specific taste receptor that tastes these particular alkaloids. And when they are sick, they just have a greater affinity. They have a greater taste for these alkaloids. So when they're sick, these particular taste receptors start firing to the nerve cells at a higher rate. And so when they encounter them, they just like, oh, this tastes really good. So they start eating more of it. So we kind of understand what they do. We don't quite understand how they know they're sick in the first place.
Tell me, why do plants produce chemicals in the first place? I mean, what's in it for the plants to have these nasty alkaloids or whatever in them? I mean, plants photosynthesize and they make carbon sugars and they grow, and this is how they work. So what are they bothering with making these terrible poisons in the first instance?
Yeah, they're definitely not making the poisons for animals' use or for our use. And in fact, the plants have evolved all these nasty chemicals to prevent being eaten or infected themselves, right? And so most of the plants out there are toxic to at least some animals. And the reason is that plants cannot run away. You know, when you think about animals and they get chased by something that wants to eat them, they can run away. But plants cannot do this. So they have evolved all sorts of things to protect them. You can think about thorns and really thick cuticles, really hairy leaves, things like that. But yeah, plants have evolved a huge variety of all sorts of chemicals that are really toxic to things that try to eat them. And then it turns out that some animals have evolved the ability to deal with that, withstand that. They have evolved resistance, and then they can start actually taking advantage of these chemicals. So rather than being deterred by them, they start using them to protect themselves against their enemies, which includes these parasites and pathogens.
So it really is an arms race. It's just interesting, you know, when you think of caffeine, which we love as coffee in our lives, this was actually evolved by the plants to keep away caterpillars and snails and herbivores that would eat them. And the coca plants, they produce cocaine, which actually stops the insects eating them by giving them tremors and wrecking their nervous systems. And then when we take the cocaine, it has this impact on our nervous systems as well, I'm sure. I don't know personally, but certainly these things that are developed by the plants to stop them being eaten by herbivores have actually lots and lots of implications in other parts of the world. So some of these plants then presumably, and a lot of them I know are being harvested by humans as medicine for themselves. And if you like, they got the heads up from watching the animals use them in the first place.
That's right. And so it's first of all, it's really intriguing, right, that these chemicals have these effects on our brain. And they didn't evolve for that reason, right? That's essentially an evolutionary side effect, because like you said, caffeine and cocaine, a lot of other chemicals evolved in these plants to really stop herbivores eating them or infections taking hold of them. You're also right that by studying animals, we've discovered these particular chemicals. And so caffeine is a great example. So the legend has it that there was a herder in Ethiopia that watched his goats eat the berries of these coffee plants. And he saw that they became really active, started dancing around. And then an abbot in a nearby monastery started brewing it. And that is how coffee was invented, essentially. The same with cocaine. So llamas in the Andes were observed to eat the coca plant, the leaves, when they were moving between different altitudes. And then people started noticing that, hey, we can actually use this too. This increases stamina. And so that's where that came from. And one of the most exciting things I find is that even the drug aspirin, which reduces inflammation, and a lot of us have used it in our lifetime, we think that that was first discovered by bears, because bears, when they come out of hibernation, they start eating the bark of willow trees, and that reduces their inflammation from that long hibernation that they had. And people all around the world have witnessed that behavior and then started using that bark as well. So even something that, you know, we take for granted as a little pharmaceutical pill had its roots most likely by observing animals.
Well, good luck with it now anyway. And it's a really exciting read. I must say, I haven't read a book that's been so exciting in a long time. Thank you very much for speaking to me.
Thank you so much for having me. It's my pleasure.
Thank you, Aina and Professor Yap Duroda. More details on the website rte.ie/Mooney. As Aina said, a fascinating read, Eric Dempsey.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm always interested in these aspects of the natural world. Is this something that they just know instinctively to do, or is it a learned behavior? For example, jays in Ireland, I've seen them what's called anting. And what they do is they will go into an ant's nest if they find one in a woodland or in a forester, and they will disturb the ants. Now, that's an interesting and a crazy thing to do, because ants can be quite aggressive if they are disturbed. And if you see a jay, he will actually lie in the ants and disturb them, and suddenly there's ants all over its body. But what it's actually doing is it's getting the ants all aggressive. They'll get on the feathers and into the quills of the bird, and they will attack and kill any parasites that may be on the jay itself. So they're using the ants to cleanse themselves of any mites or ticks or any parasites that they might have. And I believe that is a learned behavior as opposed to a natural behavior.
Oh, but it had to start somewhere, Eric.
This is the point. Who discovers this?
The first bird that did it.
Yeah, but how did they? Is it?
I don't know. But you've got me all
itchy. Yeah, yeah, I know. But what? Like, was it by accident that they just suddenly realized? Oh, you know, if I go into an ant's nest, I'll have all the ants covering me, and then suddenly I don't have any of these parasites. It's such an unusual thing to disturb a whole ant's nest just to do this, but it works very well. And some of us who are old enough to remember when everybody burnt coal fires, I remember watching jackdaws sitting on rooftops over the chimneys with their wings spread and getting fumigated by the smoke. Do you remember that noise? Have you ever seen that?
I've seen that. I even once saw a rook, another type of crow, yeah, going and picking up a smouldering cigarette butt in its beak, holding out a wing and just wafting the smouldering butt underneath the wing, presumably to use that smoke.
No,
absolutely.
That's incredible. Like you were smoking, yeah, something yourself. Are you sure you actually saw that?
Absolutely.
That's incredible.
All the species we talked about at Dublin tonight, they've been crows, but they're very, very intelligent. And this self-medication, it's often more prevalent in very intelligent species.
Yes.
So we see it particularly in many types of parrot. I've witnessed, yes, in South America parrots eating clay. And part of that is to get the nutrition from it. I mean, you wouldn't think it's very edible, but actually there's minerals in there that are important. But another theory behind it is that it's actually helping to draw out some of the toxins from some of the poisonous fruit that they might eat, which is okay in small amounts, but if they eat too much of it, it makes them feel sick. And then they'll use this clay to try and absorb some of that, and it seems to work very, very well. It's kind of like the same way that I'm sure a lot of people who own dogs will know that a dog, sometimes if it eats something that doesn't agree with it, it will deliberately eat grass to make itself,
yeah,
sick.
We had a dog called Tabby, a cat's name, I'll grant you, but that was the name of our dog. And she, when she wasn't feeling too well, would eat grass.
Yeah, to make herself sick, exactly. And that's why. We know that many species of primate, including chimpanzees and several species of monkey, when they are afflicted particularly with intestinal parasites, they will eat poisonous leaves and sometimes poisonous fruits, which... You know, obviously, there's a risk they could harm themselves, but they seem to get the dosage right so that it kills the worms or whatever are in their intestines without it actually having too much of an adverse effect on them. So there's a net benefit. And that really is medication. And the fact of it is, most human medication is also, or a great deal of it, is also very toxic. It's all about the dosage. Mm. So you want to kill the parasites, but not yourself. And that's the way that that works. And you even see it sometimes with elephants as well. I know that they eat all sorts of plants to try and help with things like childbirth. Some lemurs in Madagascar, they... the females, they eat certain leaves and fruits to help with milk production, those kind of things. So it's really fascinating how this happened, but it is very much linked often, well, not always, but often with intelligence and social behaviour.
It's interesting you talk about the parrots because, like, you know, if you're in some of these South American jungles, you know, the one thing you seek out is, you know, one of these clay licks, as they're called. And if you're there, you'll often see, you know, monkeys coming in and licking the minerals and the clay as well, because they are also eating sort of quite toxic fruit that would probably really, you know, upset us. But it just offsets the toxins that are in these fruits. I also saw a very recent video of an orangutan in Asia, and it had a very serious cut on its leg, and it was taking plants and chewing the plants into a pulp and then rubbing the wound with this mulch of leaves. And apparently the leaves, they checked out what it was, and they have quite an antiseptic quality to them. So, you know, it's like, you remember we you know, you'd get stung by a nettle and you'd look for a dock leaf, you know, and
yes.
Then you learned that and you rub it. But this was, he had this into a pulp and he was applying this pulp to the wound, and it was aiding the healing process of this wound. It's a sort of a knowledge that's sort of ingrained into their DNA in many occasions. Like, would that orangutan have been taught that by its mother? Or is it just something... It's like, you know, I'm always fascinated by nest building. How do birds know how to build a specific nest? A goldcrest doesn't go to goldcrest nesting school. It just does it, you know? How does it know how to do that? It's sort of an ingrained thing. So I'm fascinated whether some of this self-medication is something that they just know, or is it learned? And also, with habitat destruction, are these opportunities for self-medication, are they being reduced by the cutting down of forests, the clearing of these wonderful areas? What things are we missing out? As I often say, the cure for cancer could be in a rainforest, you know? No crows are smoking themselves now. Because, you know, we don't use coal in the cities. So they must now be looking for another way of getting rid of their parasites.
I came across a very interesting article, Why Wild Animals Don't Need a Vet. And it refers to the scientists and how scientists know that animals use certain plants or insects as medicine instead of just a regular food. And to find the answer, scientists would observe animals secretly to see how and when they use the plants or insects. And they can tell that the animal is using a plant or insect as a medicine if, one, the animal does not eat this plant as part of its regular diet, two, the plant being eaten provides little or no nutritional value, three, the animal mostly eats the plant or rubs it on itself during the season when other animals are catching infections, and four, the only animals in the group that are eating the plants are those that are or can be infected with a disease. Now, how's about that?
Well, I came across a really interesting example of that just recently. There's a paper recently published about a wonderful bird called the great bustard. I have to say that carefully.
Yes.
The heaviest flying bird in the world. And they're found in southern Europe, Spain and Portugal particularly, quite good for them, across into parts of Asia and that kind of area. Huge bird. And the males put on this amazing display, which almost looks like they turn themselves inside out. They have this big froth of feathers, and they do these dances, they strut around, they spend a lot of time doing this. So researchers noticed that the only thing that would really deter them from that and from their pursuit of females was they would quite regularly stop and feed on two different types of plant that were growing there, which were very limited in nutritional value, not part of the bird's normal diet, just exactly as you were describing there, Derek, and did seem to be only among these males that were doing these displays and were expending so much energy and therefore were probably depleting their immune systems and were more liable to infections. Then when they analysed these plants, they found that one of them is a very powerful anti-worming agent. It's the same chemical that's actually used in some worming treatments for domestic pets like cats and dogs. Very, very powerful. And the other one is a very strong antifungal agent, which would help to stop their feathers and also some of their internal organs from having problems with fungi. So they realise what's happening is these birds are self-medicating. And that's a really interesting one, because while these bustards are really interesting birds and very flamboyant, they wouldn't really be thought of among the most intelligent of birds. Nobody really knows. I'm sure not many people have done many studies in the intelligence of them, but they wouldn't be thought of as the brains of the animal world. So is that learned behaviour with them, or is that a very strong instinct? Is there something they have, a craving, they have to eat this? You know, that they're missing something in their bodies, they need the benefits of the medicine or the chemicals here, and something is just compelling them to eat these plants, because it's really the only thing they will interrupt their mating dances for.
Are you sure it's not an aphrodisiac?
Well, possibly so.
Anyway, stay there if you would, guys.